You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Matt McGee. Matt, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Brainerd.
Matt, we're going to talk about your show, Shapeshifter, at Ryan Lee. And I'm excited to talk about this. It's a really interesting show. And, of course, for listeners, there's images here they can dive into a little more. To begin talking about kind of the inspiration and the process of this, I know that these were in part inspired by Agnes Martin's work, right? There's a specific body of work of hers that inspired some of this?
Yes, indeed. The structure of the Shapeshifter painting is a grid, and that grid was inspired by Agnes Martin's On a Clear Day screen print edition from 1973, which is actually in the collection of the Yale University Museum there. And so it's a basic grid. While her grids are empty, I thought to suspend my own language within her grid. And I called my language graphemes, which are the very basic units of language, specifically like exclamation points and periods and ellipses. So a grapheme is what adds the emotional sense to language, basically. I've been.
You mean like a grapheme would be? Would that be an exclamation point, a comma, something like that?
Well, no, but I've kind of synthesized it down to these oval shapes, so that they become almost. They look like. I'm thinking the shorthand that maybe a reporter in a legal situation would make to make quick notes to themselves. So it's a kind of it's extemporaneous mark making, starting at the top. The painting that was in the window at Ryan Lee. I start at the top left and basically fill in the grid as if I'm writing a paragraph. So it's very spontaneous, and the color relationships are spontaneous. These series start. I mean, I did a print edition at Tamarind in 2013 on very small sheets of paper, like 14 by 12. And this idea has just kind of continued since I moved out here to the West from Manhattan.
And are you always working on paper? These are all on paper, correct?
The smaller pieces at Ryan Lee were on paper, but then the painting in the window is on canvas, and I actually rarely work on canvas, if never. And it's also unstretched, logistically, the painting had to be unstretched to get it into the window alcove at the gallery. And it was, in fact, the largest painting I've ever made on canvas. That I think it was like 88 inches by 112. So the easiest way to kind of ship it was it rolled up. That was kind of the most cost-effective way to get it from the Southwest to Manhattan.
Right. So let's talk about the language in here. You're saying you're writing these out like languages, and now it strikes me, it's almost like a kind of Morse code.
That's the word I was looking for, and it kind of always escaped. But it doesn't mean anything specifically. I don't want it to mean anything specifically. I want it to become kind of this universal encoding that is happening with our phones and with communication these days. So it's kind of a staccato kind of Morse code that it doesn't mean anything specifically. I didn't want to kind of just it be written away and pigeonholed as it's a paragraph about, you know, politics or our current, you know, like global warming, or I just want it to be this statement of kind of a 21st century way of communicating, basically. That I'm saying that off the top of my head, but yeah, I don't want it to mean anything specific, for sure.
Well, that's similar to Agnes Martin's work, isn't it? I mean, not to have, you know, abstraction does kind of have different elements to it. You know, could be spirituality, could be kind of like the kind of sort of infinite gaze kind of thing.
Famously, she said her work was about beauty, you know, which kind of is an end statement. And it's like, what do you say to that? And I'm interested in that idea. I mean, there's a lot of subtext in my work, my history, as an artist, as a human being. I mean, but ultimately it relates to Agnes Martin in kind of the simplicity. I don't want it to, it is about beauty. It's about something as simple as that.
But there's a subtext. What is the subtext in the work that you're talking about that relates to you?
My father was a geologist and archaeologist, and I almost became a geologist. My father was also he was also a mathematician, and so my history as an artist is, I mean, it's an homage to my father. My father was very methodical in how he lined up, you know, rocks in his air, just very methodical, and so. I used to do a lot of field trips with him, geological field trips, and looking at Bureau of Land Management maps. And so that kind of language is also embedded in the work. I mean, his specialty was oil exploration in sub-Saharan Africa, so he'd often do transects, fly low-flying small airplanes over a landscape to figure out where there may be oil in like Senegal and Chad and Tunisia and places like that. So that, although that has little or nothing to do with my work, it's also kind of mapping. I mean, if we can take it to that direction, the paintings are also kind of about mapping.
That sounds very close to, very interesting to talk about what he was doing in the flying. Were you there at some of that, or did he show you?
No, we lived in Libya for when I was a kid, and in England. I mean, I was actually born in France, but he would be involved in North Sea oil exploration, but then when we were in Libya, he'd disappear for, you know, 2-3 weeks at a time, and would be out in like southern Tunisia in the middle of nowhere, mapping and figuring out where. I mean, he worked for a major oil company for his career, and I hesitate to say because I think oil companies aren't probably the coolest corporations to work for these days. But yeah, and my use of to draw the grid for Shapeshifter, you know, I use grids a lot, so I use mathematical tools, you know, compasses and rulers and triangles to map out the skeleton of my paintings, kind of what I'm going to be painting in. So I use all these tools that my father used also, but ironically was horrible at math in high school and you know, in school, I was just hopeless in any math class. But now I find myself using all the tools that my father used.
Well, that's so interesting. I mean, really, that is about relationship with your father. Then that's part of the subtext is, you know, I mean, using his tools, talking about his experiences, and, you know, I guess our parents do influence us in all these ways. And while that wouldn't be obvious to the viewer, there does seem to be something almost like specimens in these grids, right? The way things are lined up scientifically.
Exactly. I mean, I inherited a lot of rocks, you know, when my father passed, like when I wanted them, so I took them. But I have them here in my studio kind of lined up on my work table. And an important part of a collection of specimens or rocks is lining them up, like seashells. You kind of, you know, you put them into rows and you compare and contrast. And so that's definitely, that idea is definitely embedded in my work. So much of my work is placement of shapes in rows or, you know, isolated shapes in rows. So it's like looking at collections, looking at specimens. Yes.
And it has such a different feeling when these are color as opposed to black and white, you know, comparing the Grapheme 16 squares, which is, you know, full of color, and the black graphene. That has a very different feeling. I mean, the idea of specimens in some ways comes forward more when we're looking at all these different colors. But the black seems to be even more like some kind of iconographic language, like hieroglyphics of some kind.
Yes, yeah, for sure. I mean, I have been to Egypt and actually looked at all those hieroglyphics, and those are also all in rows, like sentences, like, well, obviously language in sentences and vertical paragraphs, and that's all also in bug collections, you know, collections of insects. In natural history museums, at the Museum of Natural History in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, I would go and just, they have a great collection of minerals, and I love that stuff, you know, that kind of thing.
So your paintings in the Museum of Natural History.
To all about that, well, my personal history. Yeah, I mean, that's basically, and the color relationships. I mean, I like artists like Ellsworth Kelly and Myron Stout and Forrest Best, Paul Feeley, and those artists are all kind of, they've left lasting impressions on me and are woven throughout my work. I mean, it's, yeah. I also like the ideas of Annie Besant and Charles Leadbeater, who wrote in the early 20th century a book called Thought Forms. And I actually had a show in Santa Fe called Thought Forms. And they're talking about color, how color and form are assigned specific emotions. That idea is just fascinating to me, like synesthesia.
Thought Forms, that's so interesting. Yeah, I don't know that book, but that is about forms itself relating to aspects of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it was written in 1905, so kind of Freudian, you know, the ideas of Freud come into it, but pointed shapes that are red, you know, maybe about anger. I mean, it's pretty basic, but I just like this, the ideas that form and color can signify emotions for sure. I mean, if you paint with blue, it's going to be a cooler, you know, a cooler sense. So when you put a blue shape next to a purple shape or a yellow shape, you know, sparks may fly on a surface. But I mean, I think a lot of artists, you know, color relationships, all black, the graphene that's all black that was in the show at Ryan Lee, I mean, that just becomes about something else, obviously, because it's black, you know, it doesn't, you don't read the emotion, you read it as a graphic. Yeah.
Well, and also, the way these are painted, no, this isn't painted with a severity that some of the painters that you referenced might paint. We see brushwork in this. Even the lines aren't masked off. These aren't, or they don't appear to be. There's an organic quality to these, right? We see brush strokes. We see lines that have movement to it, and even the background, the white background on both the color work and the black and white work has a has a depth and a movement to it, which is departs in some ways from some of the things that you talked about in terms of a kind of a.
Ellsworth Kelly, obviously, you don't see the brushwork. His surfaces are very matte. And I actually visited his studio in Spencertown a couple of years ago, and there was a beautiful exhibition. This was after he passed. It was a Saturday, very rainy Saturday afternoon. But there was a show. I mean, I've seen his work at MoMA and everywhere, but then there was a show at his studio there, and, you know, the area where he actually produced the paintings was spattered with paint, and then next to that is this very, very pristine, smoothly painted surface. So, but then you look at a Forrest Best painting, and it's raw and crude, and, you know, very gesturally painted. I like specifically that you can see the hand of the artist in a surface. That's very important for me, and people have commented they like, you know, they look, you can't read that from a JPEG online, obviously, but that wonkiness, it's very important to have for me to show the hand of the artist, for sure. I don't have assistance. I mean, my process is what is the best thing about being an artist, is being in deep in that process, using the brush, creating that brush stroke, refining those edges, which is what I learned from Ellsworth's work, actually, is refining those edges. I like a clean edge. It may be a little wonky shape, not perfect, but make that edge clean so it interfaces with the background in a nice way.
That's so interesting, and also, yeah, it creates quite a different feeling in terms of the surface and how the viewer gets involved. I mean, we're talking about science and a number of different things. Does the spirituality enter into it, like Agnes Martin and some of the painters you referenced talk about?
That's a very important issue for me, too, spirituality, which also seems a little, I don't know, not au courant, but like Hilma af Klint had the big show at the Guggenheim, but I don't know if I use the word spirituality in my work, but I think a very successful painting has its own inner life. I don't know if inner life is the right word, but it has to resonate a sense of being itself and not, which I guess is kind of spirituality, but the surface has to have a buzz to it. And so that, you know, established either through those color relationships, that's how I kind of term spirituality, that if a surface has a buzz, its own inner life.
I like that. That makes sense. And how did these begin? You talked about how you worked on paper or canvas, but are there also drawings, preparatory drawings, or do you do it all on the canvas? Is there planning involved?
There can be, I mean, but not really. I mean, the color relationships are spontaneous. In the large painting on canvas, I've done a number of these kind of paintings on walls as murals, for example, for the Tucson Museum of Art and for the stairwell at, so similarly sized, if not larger, but temporary, there's one of these murals that looks like the painting at Ryan Lee in the stairwell at Tamarin Institute in New Mexico. That's a permanent mural. But I just start at the top left, and there's not a plan, as I don't have it painted out on a piece of paper like this is how it's going to look. It definitely is top left. I'm going to write a paragraph with graphemes in color, kind of thing, and that's just how they occur, you know, kind of thing.
So it starts with writing. Writing is the beginning, actual language itself.
Yes. In my head, it's like I am going to paint a paragraph. I guess I don't say I'm going to write a paragraph, but I definitely think of it in terms of a paragraph. And they're all square. I mean, the paintings in the window at Ryan Lee is square. So it's like, I mean, a paragraph, I guess, can be any shape, but I make my painted paragraphs in a square. I mean, yeah. So like it, like a paragraph in a book or on a page.
That makes sense. And your studio is in Arizona. That's where these are coming from, or where
yes.
is your studio?
Yes, I moved to Arizona from Manhattan in 2012, and I work at a place called Cattle Track Arts Compound. My studio is in a barn that used, this used to be a working farm and ranch. It's in the middle of Scottsdale. It's a fascinating place. Louise Nevelson worked here in the 1960s on a project for a public piece here in town. Mario Andretti, randomly, the race car driver, made his fiberglass models for his race cars here on the property. The founder of the Phoenix Art Museum, Phil Curtis, lived on the property until his death in the late 70s. So it's a very and the family who owns the property, we've received two Rauschenberg Foundation grants for operating costs. It operates as a nonprofit. But the family who owned this place moved here from the Northeast in the 1930s and set up kind of a ranch and farming space. They had 150 acres. Now they have 11 acres. But it has a history of attracting artists. And, yeah, my studio space is not large, but it kind of relates to every studio space I ever had in Brooklyn. And I'm able to generate shows. It's private and quiet, and I have a window unit because it does get 120 degrees here, so I have fans and air conditioning, and yeah, it's a great place to work for sure.
And is that? I mean, that's quite different than New York. Working there has it changed the work at all? Being in that environment?
Yes. Well, I mean, I. When I was living in Manhattan, I always had a day job. I mean, I worked for Robert Rauschenberg for 20 years in Lower Manhattan, and that was one. And I worked at the Guggenheim. I worked for galleries in Soho. But moving out here, the cost of living is such that I don't have a day job, and I've been able to support myself with my work in the studio, which it took me having to leave my life in New York to finally, you know, really be able to focus on my work. I mean, the cost of living in Manhattan, I always had to have some kind of job during the day and could really only focus on the studio work evenings and weekends. But here, I'm almost 65. I've just been able to completely focus. I'm in the studio basically 6-7 days a week and can generate shows. And I have product, and galleries need product, and that's what I can offer them, basically.
Well, that's good to hear. It sounds like a great life out there.
It's, yeah, and it's, you know, Phoenix is, I don't know if it has a, politically it's changing. It's, I think people see Arizona as kind of a gun-toting cowboy kind of state, but it's not at all. And, you know, I lived in Brooklyn in very tiny apartments with no light for 30, 35 years. And, here in the West, obviously, it's all about sky, and you can see the sun and the landscape, the mountains on to the west and north and east. I mean, you can see into the distance, and it gives you a broad sense of perspective. So there's this space. There is a lot of space in my work now. I mean, there's white areas, you know, with the shapes. There's nothing kind of cluttered about the work I've been doing lately. There's space, which I think is the mind space that the landscape offers, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's been such a pleasure talking to you about all this. I want to thank you for talking with me. And of course, for listeners, there's links here so they can see much more. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Matt. I wish you well with your work, and thank you again.
Thank you, Brainerd. That was fantastic. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.